From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Noah Feldman about his work advising the Iraqi Governing Council on a new constitution. He's also the author of the book After Jihad, America and the Struggle for Islamic Democracy. Also, we meet Eitan Gorlin, writer and director of the new film The Holy Land. It's loosely based on his experiences working at a bar in Jerusalem where Jews, Palestinians, and journalists drank. Kevin Whitehead reviews a new compilation of Bob Hope's recordings, and book critic Maureen Corrigan considers Vivian Gornick's admission that she invented some scenes and conversations in her highly regarded memoir, Fierce Attachments. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Leaders of the Episcopal Church have started debate on whether to confirm Gene Robinson, who's seeking to become the denomination's first openly gay bishop. The debate comes after a report from Bishop Gordon Scruton, who conducted an investigation into allegations of sexual misconduct against Robinson.
It is my conclusion that there is no necessity to pursue further investigation, and no reason on these grounds to prevent the bishops with jurisdiction from going forward with their voting about whether or not to consent to Canon Robinson's consecration.
The bishops are expected to start voting soon on Robinson's confirmation, but the process is conducted by paper ballot, so it could be some time before results are available. Fighting appears to have stopped in Liberia since the arrival of the first contingents of Nigerian peacekeepers at the airport outside Monrovia. NPR's Jason Bobian says people have started to come out from cover in the Liberian capital.
Monrovia has really been a city under siege for the last 2 weeks. When people went out and about, they were ducking from one wall to another to avoid any gunfire, out of fear that mortars might go off around them. Today, people are out in the streets, they're shopping, people are gathering outside of video cafes, and they've got videos playing in the windows.
NPR's Jason Bobian in Monrovia. A suspected suicide car bombing in Jakarta has killed at least 13 people and injured nearly 150. Two Americans were among those wounded in the blast, which ripped through the front of the 33-story Marriott Hotel during the lunch hour. The BBC's Rachel Harvey says the blast caused heavy damage.
Dark has fallen, and it's rather surreal. I'm actually sitting under a row of tropical palm trees, but just behind that is the hotel itself, and that's still a scene of real destruction. The bottom floors are completely blackened. There are bits of water where it looks like maybe pipes have burst, bits of glass still across the ground in front of the hotel. The upper floors of this tall, modern building were made of mirrored reflective glass, and a lot of that glass has now been blown out.
The BBC's Rachel Harvey. California Governor Gray Davis got some help today in his fight to survive a recall election in October. NPR's John McChesney reports.
The boost comes from labor as national AFL-CIO leaders voted to oppose the recall and urged other Democrats not to run in the October 7th election. Davis spoke before the executive council of the organization, which voted unanimously to support him. Davis is asking the unions to cough up $10 million to help him fight the recall. Individual unions have to decide if they want to contribute. That's about half the amount the Davis camp says it needs to raise. John McChesney, NPR News, San Francisco.
The Dow lost 150. To close at 9,036. This is NPR News. A new study says children who witness violence can experience post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, and behavioral problems. The study, published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, shows little difference between early and delayed treatment. NPR's Vicky Quay reports.
Researchers at the RAND Corporation studied about 120 sixth graders at two Los Angeles schools who said they had witnessed violence involving knives and guns. The children had significant symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, such as nightmares. The children were treated with 10 therapy sessions. Some children had them right away, others several months later. Researchers report children in the early sessions initially had fewer symptoms compared to those in the later group. But at 6 months, after both groups had received the therapy, there was no difference in levels of symptoms of PTSD or depression. Teachers also reported no differences in classroom behaviors. Vicky Quay, NPR News.
The Department of Homeland Security is calling for greater scrutiny of electronic devices such as CD players and laptop computers carried by travelers at the nation's airports. The department issued an advisory to law enforcement agencies today, saying that terrorists may use electronic devices, including digital cameras, to conceal weapons or explosives. The Air Travelers Association predicted that the greater scrutiny of electronic devices could mean longer lines at security checkpoints. Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The NASDAQ Composite Index lost 40 points, or more than 2.3%, to close at 1,673. The S&P 500 was down 17 to 965. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from American Legacy Foundation, dedicated to building a world where young people reject tobacco and anyone can quit. www.americanlegacy.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Noah Feldman, is currently advising the Iraqi Governing Council on the creation of a new constitution. He spent part of the spring and summer in Baghdad working with the U.S. Office for Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance, advising on issues pertaining to the structure of government, including the constitutional process. Feldman is a professor at the NYU School of Law, where he co-directs the Center on Law and Security. His new book, After Jihad, America and the Struggle for Islamic Democracy, poses the question, can democracy be made to flourish in the lands where Islam prevails? He argues that it can. I asked him why he believes that, at a time when many people fear that an Islamic government will lean toward fundamentalist extremism and become more of a theocracy than a democracy.
The reason is that Muslims themselves say so. An increasingly large number of Muslims, and in Iraq, just to give one example, this group of Muslims are probably the majority, say openly that they think that their Islamic values are compatible with democracy, that they interpret Islam in such a way as to demand the rule of law, as to demand equality for all people, men and women, Muslims and non-Muslims, and to demand elections. So if enough Muslims say that this is their commitment and belief, then I believe that there will be a version of Islam that will emerge as compatible with democracy. It just turns entirely on Muslims themselves.
Let me give you an example of the kind of thing I think a lot of people are worried about in terms of an Islamic democracy. There's an article this week in the New York Times about how now that the Iraqi courts have virtually disappeared, some young clerics are holding court, so to speak, and giving their opinions about how things should be handled. And in this article, it described a man who killed his mother because she had been sullying the family name by committing adultery since he was a boy, so he murdered her. And he thought that that was the just thing to do. And he went to the cleric, basically, you know, in the hopes that the cleric would tell him that he did the right thing. And these clerics apparently have given religious approval to certain killings, like killing members of the Ba'athist party, the Ba'athist government, the government of Saddam Hussein. What do you think of this? Did you read the article, and what did you think of these clerics and what that has to say about the possibilities of Islamic democracy in Iraq?
I did read the article, and one of the key elements of the article is that, according to the leadership of the Muslim community in Iraq, of the Shi'i community, the people running this so-called court are unauthorized, young, essentially graduate students who are clearly relatively radical, associated with one of the more radical factions, and whose views don't actually reflect traditional Islamic law, something that was made very clear by the senior clerics when interviewed. So, for example, the idea that one could, of one's own accord, murder a family member who was suspected of adultery is absolutely out of accord with Islamic law. It's not in any way compatible with Islamic teaching. And the fact that the clerics, or the wannabe clerics, as it were, in the article agreed to this, as the article reported, is just a wonderful proof that they're not following Islamic law. Instead, they're acting like revolutionaries who are doing what they can in a kind of situation of vacuum with respect to the courts in Iraq. There are secular courts, but they're not yet working in an extensive way. And so these young bucks, as it were, are getting into the act by stepping up and offering rough justice, but they're not offering classical Islamic justice. So I think that for Islam and something like the rule of law to work together, what you need are properly constituted courts. And if a bunch of law students no offense to law students, I love law students, I was one relatively recently myself, but if a bunch of law students got together and decided in a revolutionary moment here that they were just going to dole out the law, I don't think we would consider that to be a proof that democracy and our system were incompatible. We would just say that those folks don't know the law yet.
You know, for some people, when they think of Islamic justice, they think of stoning a woman to death for adultery or honor killings, killing a woman because she has sexually sullied the family reputation. Is that classic Islamic justice or is that extremism?
Certainly, honor killings are not authorized by Islamic law. They are absolutely not authorized. To the extent that execution is permitted under classical Islamic law, it's only after a trial at which the standard of proof is extraordinarily high. Now, it's true that classical Islamic law, much like classical Jewish law, in theory prescribes some very drastic punishments for things like adultery. So you can find it on the books that a woman properly convicted of adultery, which means that responsible witnesses in full broad daylight saw the adulterous act in person, which if you can think about it is a relatively unusual set of circumstances, that in principle a capital punishment is prescribed. But in practice, such things are rarely, if ever, brought about under classical Islamic legal sources. There are one or two instances of this happening or something equivalent happening in Saudi Arabia, and I think those are terrible. It's really a shame that such a thing could happen. But operating within Islamic law, it's entirely possible to avoid ever executing a punishment like that. What we're seeing is a legal system that has the capacity to evolve in much the same way that Western legal systems have the capacity to evolve. And things that we regularly punished with the death penalty 100 or 200 or 300 years ago, we wouldn't imagine of imposing that sort of punishment for today. Islam has that same capacity to develop on its own.
Are you worried that in the vacuum that's being created now in that period before a new constitution, before courts are reestablished, before a government is reestablished, are you worried that in this vacuum, courts like these extremist young clerics setting up are going to prosper, and that other forms of what you described as rough justice will come into being, and that they'll be maybe hard to dislodge?
It worries me a lot, because setting up a responsible justice system is the most important task, I think, of a government in making itself legitimate. If the citizens aren't going to your courts, but they're going to somebody else's courts, it's pretty hard to say that you're really the overall most important government in place. So I am concerned about it. On the other hand, there's a way to combat it, too. And the way to combat it is to pour a lot of resources into getting the Iraqi courts reconstituted up and running. And the people whom I had the privilege of working with in Iraq who were working on these issues were on the right track. They knew exactly what they were doing, and they had a good plan in place to reconstitute the justice system. It's really simply a question of resources. And it's my view that we need to put a lot more resources than we have been putting into that task, exactly to avoid the problem that you describe.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Noah Feldman. He's the author of the book After Jihad, America and the Struggle for Islamic Democracy, and the book makes the case for Islamic democracy. He is also now advising the Iraqis on forming a new constitution. Can you give us an example of an interesting and telling disagreement among the Iraqis working on the new constitution about a fundamental principle that should or should not be in the constitution?
One crucial subject is federalism in the new constitution. There's broad agreement among almost all the Iraqis that I spoke to that the new Iraq has to be federal in some way. In other words, there has to be a region that corresponds roughly, or a series of regions that correspond roughly, to where most of the Kurds live in the northern part of the country. And there also need to be other regions, perhaps a central Baghdad region, perhaps a southern region, perhaps multiple regions broken up roughly according to the governorates. Where the Iraqis disagree, though, pretty deeply, is about how much autonomy these individual regions ought to have. The Kurds would like a maximum amount of autonomy. They've got a history of being oppressed by the central government. They have a different language, or rather different languages. They have a culture that's distinctive in many ways. They want as much independence as they can possibly get. And the rest of the country is concerned that there's a danger that if a Kurdistan or a Kurdish region has too much independence, that could lead to the possibility of it seceding and breaking the country apart, which is a result that nobody in Iraq really wants very much. So the debate about how much federalism there should be is actually going to be a very, very serious and extensive debate. Even though it sounds as if all sides roughly agree on federalism, that actually doesn't tell you very much. There needs to be a lot of discussion about who's going to rule what and from where.
One of the fundamental principles of America's democracy is the separation of church and state. In Iraq, is it likely to is the Constitution not likely to say anything about the separation of church and state? Is it likely to be an Islamic democracy that doesn't have that clear line that America has tried to uphold?
I say in my book, After Jihad, that in America we have trouble imagining a democracy without the separation of church and state, but that in most Muslim countries, and Iraq is one in this respect, it's just about impossible to imagine a true democracy that had an absolute separation of church and state. The reason for that is that the vast majority of people in Iraq, for example, would like Islam to play at least some symbolic or value-providing role in their government, which doesn't mean that the country will be governed by Islamic law, because I don't think that will be the case. What it means is that the Constitution will either acknowledge Islam as the religion of 95% or perhaps a little bit more of all Iraqis, or it will acknowledge that the values of Islam matter to the Iraqi people, and it will also do so alongside a commitment to democracy, a commitment to equality, and a commitment to basic liberties. So what we'll have is a state that is both democratic and, in some sense, Islamic. You know, the phrase Islamic State conjures up in people's minds a picture of Iran, of a government by mullahs. And that's not going to happen in Iraq. It shouldn't happen in Iraq, and I'm confident that it will not. But a state can be Islamic in other ways, too. It can be Islamic in the sense that Islamic values affect people's decisions, in the sense that when legislation is passed, people think about Islamic values. When there are public events, the prayers that, let's say, consecrate those events take place in Arabic or are Muslim prayers. And all of those things can happen alongside a robust democracy, in my view, and increasingly in the view of many Iraqis too.
Before you started directly advising the Iraqis, you were working with the Bush administration in consulting on the formation of an Iraqi constitution. Historically, do you think that the United States has worked on behalf of democracy in the Islamic world and the Arab world?
Absolutely not. Our history is one of, it's a shameful history, really, of, for the most part, supporting dictators because we were concerned to keep the oil flowing, and we thought that stability was the key to keeping the oil flowing, and we thought that the dictators were in a position to keep that process going. Now, there may have been some justification for this approach, maybe during the Cold War, when there was a concern that some of the countries of the region might become Soviet allies, might become communist or socialist, and as indeed some did, if they weren't kept in line by a heavy-handed dictator. So perhaps then there was some justification for this, but there really isn't any now that the Cold War is over. And what's more, after September 11th, we can no longer tell ourselves that having autocrats on our side in the region ensures that our interests are protected, because one of the motivations of bin Laden and of the Al-Qaeda terrorists was to attack us because of our support of regimes in the region, like the Saudi government. So given that it's no longer an approach that keeps us safe, given that supporting dictators is no longer an approach that can be justified by some broader purposes of the state, I think it's an approach that's got to change.
Do you think the Bush administration thinks that way too? And do you think the Bush administration and that the president himself would agree with you in your analysis that we have been on the wrong side historically, that we haven't supported democracy, we've supported the autocrats?
It's difficult for presidents, any president of any party, to announce that past U.S. policy has been wrongheaded, and I'm guessing that it's especially difficult to do that if one's own father was part of that policy. On the other hand, people vote with their feet, and so do countries sometimes. And by our intervention in Iraq, we've certainly signaled that we're ready for things to change very significantly. Certainly, the invasion of Iraq, or the liberation, if you prefer to call it that, marks a fundamental change in our approach to the region and our public commitment to creating democracy there, a commitment which everything that I saw suggests is actually shared, is not some public consumption doctrine that, in fact, is secretly being undermined. Suggest that we really are interested in changing our policies in the region. Now, we haven't changed our policies everywhere. There are still plenty of autocratic governments that are being propped and upped and shored up by us. But by creating a democracy in the region, or helping create a democracy in the region, which is our stated policy at this point, we're going to send shockwaves through the governments of the autocratic Arab rulers. There's no question about that. When the Iraqi Constitutional Convention is broadcast live in Arabic on Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya and Abu Dhabi TV, it's going to be watched in Cairo. going to be watched in Damascus. It's going to be watched in Riyadh and Jeddah in Saudi Arabia. And that's going to have a big, big effect on the region. And believe me, the governments of the region know that perfectly well.
My guest is Noah Feldman. He's consulting with the Iraqi Governing Council on the creation of a new constitution. His new book is called After Jihad. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Noah Feldman is my guest. He's the author of the book After Jihad, America and the Struggle for Islamic Democracy. He's now consulting with the Iraqis on writing a new constitution. Noah Feldman, let me point out here that you are Jewish and that you grew up in an Orthodox family. And, you know, there is a lot of anti-Semitism right now in the Islamic world and a lot of conspiracy theories about what the Jews are responsible for. What's it like for you, as somebody who is Jewish, to be consulting now on the formation of an Islamic democracy?
There are a lot of conspiracy theories around. You're absolutely right. And in the Arab press, one regularly sees anti-Semitic language and arguments that had become actually relatively more rare over the last decade or so. They're experiencing a resurgence now. It's a very troubling phenomenon. But as with many forms of prejudice, it's more abstract than particular. When I was in Iraq, speaking with Iraqis, everyone from, you know, ordinary people on the street to college students, lawyers, even a professor at the Islamic University in Baghdad, I didn't experience any anti-Semitism directed towards me. To the contrary, people were often sort of interested in a kind of, gee, never met one before way to find out that I was Jewish. And of course, these are not ordinary circumstances. I was there as part of a U.S. government operation that includes soldiers with guns. So it was not as if I was in any physical danger.
At what point does it usually come up that you're Jewish? Is it something that you bring up? Do they ask you about your religious background? Do they know enough to know that, like, Feldman, sounds like a Jewish name?
It's funny. In the Arab world, first names matter a lot more than last names. And the Arabic version of the name Noah is Nuh. And in Arabic, that name is generally a Christian name. It's generally Christian Arabs who have that name. So based on first name alone, I think very often people don't quite gather that I'm Jewish. So it's something that comes up in the course of conversation if the subject turns to religion. In the case of the professor at the Islamic University with whom I had a conversation, we were sort of talking about high-flown ideas of democracy and Islam and were they compatible, many of the subjects that you and I were just discussing. And about two-thirds of the way, he stopped and he turned and looked at me full on and he said to me, "Are you Christian?" And it was very clear that he expected a no for an answer. And for a second, I thought to myself, well, you know, what answer ought I to give under these conditions and circumstances? And then I said to him, "No, I'm Jewish." And he nodded his head sort of sagely and stroked his beard. And we went on with the conversation. He didn't offer a comment on it one way or the other. So that was how it came up in that context. One time it came up because I visited a traditional Jewish shrine site in Iraq in a town called Kifl, which is reputed to be the gravesite of the prophet Ezekiel. And this was a synagogue for well over 1,000 years. It's a very, very beautiful building. Now it's functioning as a mosque. And I was reading the Hebrew inscriptions, which are for the most part well preserved in the building. And someone came over to me there, one of the local people, and he obviously knew that I was Jewish. And we had a lengthy conversation about the Jewish community of the town and what buildings they had built and which houses they had lived in. And he introduced me to one old man who was 90-some years old who could still recite poems that he said had been written by one of the Jewish inhabitants of the town. And there, people were actually remarkably welcoming. It's obviously not a typical town, but they had very, very warm memories of their Jewish residents. And when we asked the oldest living man in the town how he felt about the possibility of the Jews returning, he said, "Well, I'm 90-some years old. I can't read and I can't write, but it seems to me that a good person is a good person." And I was very struck by that answer, and the people in the crowd that had gathered around to listen to the words of this wise old man seemed pretty receptive to it.
Let's get back to consulting on the Iraqi constitution. Would you like to see in that constitution something that ensures equal rights and human rights for people who are not of the Islamic faith. For Jews, for instance, there had been a thriving Jewish population in Iraq. Most of the Jews fled because of discrimination and persecution.
The Iraqi constitution has to guarantee equal treatment before the law for all Iraqi citizens, regardless of faith and regardless of sex as well. That's hugely important.
That gets to the question, is if it's like an Islamic democracy, if there isn't a separation of church and state, what is the place for people whose beliefs are different and whose religious law is different?
With respect to governing their own religious lives, people should be able to use their own religious faiths, and the Constitution should guarantee that. And Islam, in principle, should permit that, because the Quran itself says that there shall be no coercion in matters of religion, and people should be, in a state that's truly democratic and truly Islamic, free to practice their faiths as they choose and be free of discrimination on those points. Now, it's certainly true that if there's a debate about some point of the criminal law, let's say, in the Iraqi legislature, and some of the legislators think that some point derived from Islamic tradition with respect to, let's say, the standard of proof ought to be dominant. And if a Christian, let's say, because there are many Christians living in Iraq now, there are perhaps 500,000 Christians living in Iraq now, got up in the legislature and said, well, you know, actually our legal tradition is different on this point, or I don't think that the Islamic point should prevail, it should be fine for that legislator to say that. When they vote, it may be that the fact that there are a small minority of people who are Christians, you know, you're talking about 500,000 people out of a country of 25 million, will mean that that view won't carry the day. But it needs to be possible for everyone to get their views out there and to speak freely. And similarly, it has to be guaranteed that everyone who lives and functions in Iraq is treated as a full Iraqi citizen. But Islam should not only permit but require that, as understood by many, many Muslims. And democracy, what's more, requires that. So remember that when I speak of an Islamic democracy, I don't mean that it's less democratic. I mean something that's fully and authentically and legitimately democratic, meaning that it guarantees equality of all persons, that it guarantees rights, and that it also is in some meaningful way something that reflects Islamic values at the same time.
Noah Feldman, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a great pleasure.
Noah Feldman is consulting with the Iraqi Governing Council on the creation of a new constitution. He's also the author of the book After Jihad, and he co-directs the Center for Law and Security at NYU. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Harper Business, publisher of The Intelligent Investor by Benjamin Graham. Principles for Value Investing, newly updated by Jason Zweig, with a preface by Warren Buffett. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Eitan Gorlin, writer and director of the film The Holy Land, based on his experiences working at a Jerusalem bar where Jews and Palestinians drank. Kevin Whitehead reviews a new collection of Bob Hope's vocal recordings. And book critic Maureen Corrigan considers Vivian Gornick's admission that she invented some scenes in her memoir.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Last week, we said goodbye to Bob Hope, who died just 2 months after his 100th birthday. A new compilation of Hope recordings has just been released. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead checked it out. Here's his review.
Every morning, every evening, ain't we got fun?
Not much money. Oh, but honey, ain't we got fun?
If wifey wishes to go to a play,
don't wash the dishes, just throw them away. In the winter,
Bob Hope, 1949, with Margaret Whiting. As much as we've heard about Hope, the compulsive entertainer and self-deprecating gag man, little's been said about his singing. But he'd started in vaudeville as a song and dance man and had come to Hollywood via Broadway, where he introduced the song I Can't Get Started. His theme, Thanks for the Memory, comes from his first movie, The Big Broadcast of 1938. It showed off his pleasing light baritone and soft-shoe delivery, but Hope was too irrepressible to play it straight for long. Even in the recording studio, he liked to work with a comic foil. Why waste that perfect timing?
We've got nothing, got nothing in common, but nothing in common. We're sorry to state the roads we travel, the large laughs with L'Amour.
Yes, sir.
Those days are over.
Oh, now, wait a minute, Dad. Don't be so sure.
That's right. TV's won 'em.
They got 'em.
They're gonna rerun them.
Ouch.
We look like the Bobbsey twins.
I'm gonna shun them. Because they'll be on too late.
Yeah, you'll have your Shaw and your Ovaltine by then.
The road picks were such kicks, but let's nix any encores.
Because outside of still looking youthful and cute,
and outside of stealing all that Paramount loot,
we grabbed a bundle.
What bandits?
We got nothing in common at all.
Hope with Bing Crosby, his partner in seven road pictures, those deconstructionist marvels which took your money and then kept reminding you how little you were getting for it. This music is from a timely compilation from Capitol, optimistically titled The Best of Bob Hope. It's not that, but it's okay. A grab bag of mostly jokey mid-century singles and album tracks, which also pair him with Dorothy L'Amour, Jane Russell, and Edie Adams. Wandering off on his own, things could get surrealer.
The last time I saw Paris, her heart was warm and gay.
I heard the laughter of her heart in every street cafe.
Hey, garçon. Oui, monsieur? Tell me, have you seen a girl?
A girl? What kind of a girl?
Any kind. My boat leaves tomorrow. Say, do you think that girl sitting over there would be offended if I said hello?
Monsieur, she has winked at you. She has dropped her handkerchief. And right now she is smiling at you. What does that usually mean to you?
She's a policewoman.
Ah, Bob Hope, the lovable, leering coward. Lovable because you could tell the persona from the real man. The real Hope did USO shows from Greenland to the South Pacific. The character hit the road with Bing to Bali or Zanzibar without leaving the Paramount lot. There they made cheerful travesties of one culture and musical culture after another in a way that was recognizably tasteless even by the end of the cycle. They were at it as late as 1962 on the road to Hong Kong.
Kowloon, oh Kowloon, we can't get there too soon. 'Cause a gal who's cute has the cutest lute that I'm just dying to tune. Can't you taste those crazy kumquats?
Oh, isn't life a merry song
when a Chinese gong goes ding, ding, dong? We'll be on the happy road to Hong Kong.
One of the less offensive verses. You could fairly draw a parallel between the writer's happy ignorance of whatever country the boys set out for and the real foreign adventures that sent Hope packing to Vietnam or Saudi Arabia. Those dark clouds over the road movie's sunlit surface make these imperial comedies weirdly poignant. Bob Hope's own complex appeal is caught up in that. The guy had a lot of layers. You can hear it when he sings.
All thanks to the memory of all you flying men. We can't remember when we've had more royal treatment. Hope we'll soon be back again. And thank you so much. All thanks to the memory of pilots zooming planes through navigators' lanes, you gunners, ground crews, bombardiers who further freedom's gains. We thank you so much. Bombs are a way most effective to help these men reach their objective. Look ahead with a freedom perspective. Let's all pitch in. We're out to win. Ladies and gentlemen, to Colonel Estabrook, Major Becker, Lieutenant Kuhn, and all the officers and men who helped us with our broadcast here at Patterson Field, and all you fellas over at Lockburn Field where we played last night, we want to say thanks for the whole gang. Next week, we'll be in Indianapolis, Indiana, broadcasting from Camp Atterbury. Good night, everybody.
Kevin Whitehead writes for the Chicago Reader and the Chicago Sun-Times. He reviewed Best of Bob Hope on the Capitol label. Coming up, working at a Jerusalem bar frequented by Jews, Palestinians, and journalists, we'll meet the writer and director of the new film, The Holy Land. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Eitan Gorlin, wrote and directed the film The Holy Land. It won the Grand Jury Prize for Best Feature Film at last year's Slam Dance Film Festival, which is a low-budget answer to Sundance. The film is very loosely based on his own experiences and observations. Gorlin grew up in an American Orthodox Jewish home, studied at a yeshiva, then went to Israel for a year to study at a Zionist yeshiva. He went back to Israel after graduating from college and worked as a bartender for a year. The Holy Land is about an Orthodox yeshiva student in Israel named Mendy, who is having trouble focusing on his studies. One of the things distracting him is his growing sexual urges. His rabbi quotes an obscure Talmudic passage and suggests that Mendy visit a prostitute to get it out of his system. The rabbi thinks the student will be back in no time, but that's not what happens. When Mendy ventures out to Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, he falls in love with Sasha, a Russian emigre prostitute, and becomes friends with Mike, the owner of a bar in Jerusalem. In this scene, Mendy and Mike are talking late at night on the beach after the bars have closed.
Christ, I need a drink. What's open around here?
I don't know. I don't live in Tel Aviv. I guess everything's closed by now.
Yuppie f***s. I don't even think about closing my bar till I hear buses running.
You own a bar?
Yeah, in Jerusalem.
Jerusalem? I didn't know there were any bars in Jerusalem.
Mike's place. Mike. Me, Mike, Mike's place.
Oh,
you
yeah.
Craziest bar east of Sarajevo.
You've been to Sarajevo?
Sure. Still be there if it wasn't for those f***ing peacekeepers. I used to be a war photographer. Are you a drinker?
Sure.
What are you doing Wednesday?
Nothing.
No, no. Coming to my bar in Jerusalem. Got a great band playing. Everybody's gonna be there. Even the Love Boat girls.
Is Sasha gonna be there?
You really like her, don't you?
Eitan Gorlin, welcome to Fresh Air. Some of the story in the Holy Land is set in a bar in Jerusalem, which is modeled on a place called Mike's Place, a real bar in Jerusalem, where you actually worked as a bartender. Would you describe the real bar?
Well, the real bar was founded by somebody who's still a very close friend of mine and lives in Canada now, Mike. And he was a Canadian war photographer who came to Israel to shoot the first Intifada and the first Gulf War. And about 1992, he opened a bar. And the real Mike's Place was tiny. It was quite narrow. You had to descend a couple of steps to get into it. You couldn't see in, you couldn't see out. And we kept the bar open basically until we heard the buses running. So, you know, most bars in Jerusalem, I mean, it was a heavy drinking bar. And the kind of music we played was sort of like Jim Morrison and Janis Joplin. It was a little bit of a throwback to the sort of like wild early 70s. I think that was kind of what Mike was going for. But it was mostly the clientele, because Mike himself was a photojournalist. We had a lot of journalists and war photographers who would come through. But, for example, we'd have, like, when I worked there, there was an Irish construction crew which was doing renovations on the Dome of the Rock. And since it's the Jordanians who control the dome, they pay, you know, they're the ones who paid for the construction firm. So it's the construction company that was doing a lot of work in the Middle East. And these guys who are now working on the Dome of the Rock had just come from Iraq, where they were building Saddam Hussein's palaces. And if you remember the run-up to the first Gulf War, where Saddam took some Westerners hostage just sort of to buy time. So some of these guys who are now sitting at our bar and renovating the Dome of the Rock had just been hostages of Saddam Hussein, though they told us that it was, you know, they ate caviar and it was all quite pleasant. And next to them, you would find local Arabs, you know, Jerusalem Arabs who lived in the city. We had people from the former Soviet Union, people who had left Eastern Europe. And it was just this real eclectic mix of people. And I remember, like, 6 o'clock in the morning, we would look around and say, what are all these people doing in the same room? Which in some respect is what I say about Israel. What are all these people doing in the same room?
In your movie, The Holy Land, Mendy, the rabbinical student, you know, when he goes out into the world, the person who he becomes closest to is a prostitute, because after all, his rabbi basically has given him this advice, you know, meet a prostitute. You're so absorbed in your own sexual urges, go into the outside world and actually meet a prostitute. So he does, and he meets her, and he falls in love with her. Is there a big prostitution trade in Israel? Was there one when you were living there?
10, 15 years ago, I mean, there were prostitutes in Israel, but, you know, really it's something you'd barely notice. But, I mean, it reached proportions where you can't miss it. I mean, I've been to Amsterdam, I've been to Bangkok. I mean, it's, I think, at that same level. It's not something, if you were to just stroll through Tel Aviv, it's not, I mean, you couldn't miss it.
There's a character in the movie called the Exterminator. Describe his character in the movie and who he's based on in real life.
Well, I mean, I spent, you know, the year that I spent studying in Israel, it was, I think, 86, 87, before the first intifada broke out. And I studied in a yeshiva that was very much, very messianic and very much involved in the settler movement. And each weekend they would take us to different caravans on hilltops. And I really had a chance to meet some of the most important people in the settler movement before anybody else had heard of them. I mean, it's basically people who believe that, even though I think today most settlers are economic settlers, which means that rent in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv is so high that you just get more space for less money. But at the core of the movement are people who believe very, very strongly in something. And they believe that we're on the cusp of messianic times. And in a sense, they're kind of ashamed of the last 2,000 years of Jewish history. And they kind of want to turn the clock back to when Jews were priests and warriors. And they're very much about expanding the borders of Israel and about sort of forcing the Messiah to come. The Exterminator specifically, so that's kind of the background. That's sort of, I mean, these are people who I lived with and traveled with, and some of whom are relatives of mine. But this specific character is based where I actually was hitchhiking with a friend from Jerusalem to Hebron, and there was a car that stopped for us. A settler car stopped, but different from the film. I remember him saying, you can't sit in the front seat. It didn't make any sense to me why the front seat was open, why I couldn't sit there. And he said, no, I need it for my gun. And then as we drove, he never passed 15 kilometers on the speed limit. And he would just sort of, the M16 would go out the left window, would go out the right window. And the entire time, he insisted on talking to us in Hebrew, even though we were both American and very well spoke English. And he called himself the Exterminator.
So this is somebody who you met who basically drove through the territories with a gun, almost doing target practice, looking for Palestinians?
Well, he, at least in the ride that we took, he didn't shoot anybody, but he was basically looking for stone throwers. He kept saying he was always to point to these. He says, that's where they hide. Actually, what he was doing was he was delivering. Another thing that happens, a lot of these settlers, when they get into trouble, you know, because they shoot somebody, often they kill somebody, and they get house arrest where they can't leave their house. So this person was actually delivering food to different very prominent settlers. And I guess that was his job. He would sort of, I guess, bring food from Jerusalem. I'm not quite sure, but I think it was packed with food, and he was delivering food to prominent settlers who weren't allowed to leave their homes.
Now, your story, your own personal story, has some parallels with the story of the rabbinical student Mendy in your film, The Holy Land. You grew up in an Orthodox home in the United States. went to Israel, studied in an ultra-Orthodox yeshiva, lived in the occupied territory.
Well, I wouldn't refer to that as ultra-Orthodox. Ultra-Orthodox usually connotes the people in the black outfits who aren't particularly Zionist, and they're much more fundamentalist in their orientation. The school that I studied in, which was actually what was kind of a little bit exciting about it for me, was put less emphasis on the fundamentalism and more emphasis on the nationalism and sort of being on the cusp of history, almost like these larger-than-life historical players.
So in the community that you were living, did men wear the black hats and have the beards and payas, the long sideburns?
No, the house that I grew up in, no. My father has a PhD from Columbia, and but the school that I switched to was along those lines. Like I originally went to what you'd call like a kind of a co-ed modern Orthodox school. But as I said, you know, I kind of was very curious and I was sort of rebellious. And I was also influenced by a teacher, which I think is something that also happens in the Muslim world and also happens in the Jewish world, where, and I think you read about this a lot in the Muslim world, where it's the teachers who very much influence the kids. Because you might take like a typical Moroccan, you know, typical Muslim Moroccan family who is quite moderate, actually, and not that extreme in their religion, but they don't know enough Quran to teach the kids Quran. So they kind of bring in these teachers from the outside, and it's these teachers, you know, who are proficient in Quran who then influence the kids. What people aren't paying attention to is how radical and extreme the teachers are. And I think there was something similar also sort of in the modern Orthodox world among Jews, where it was hard to find teachers who could propagate sort of a middle road. So the teachers were quite extreme and came from sort of extreme backgrounds and often influenced the kids. So then you kind of spend a couple of years not quite sure who to listen to, and you just sort of bounce around until you find your place.
In your movie, The Holy Land, Mendy, the rabbinical student who leaves the yeshiva to experience life for what he thinks will be just a few days, says to his rabbi, when his rabbi tries to convince him to come back, he says to his rabbi that he wants to find God in life. You know, he wants to see God in the real world, not just to experience God in the confines of the yeshiva and in the confines of the very orthodox life. Has that been something you would describe as an ambition of yours?
I think one of the things one of my biggest questions growing up Orthodox was that the stories we read and the heroes we were supposed to worship were so different than the lives we were living. Because we kept reading about these, you know, King David had the story with Bathsheba, and the biblical stories were people who were living life to its fullest. They were warriors, they were killers, they were adulterers. You know, they were involved with black magic, sometimes witches, and they were just living this really exciting, at times perhaps immoral, but they were definitely sucking the marrow out of the bone. And yet we would read these stories, be told these, you know, that these are our heroes, and these people are almost like, you know, as close to God as a human being could be. But then they would say, you know, you can't look at a woman, or a woman needs to cover her hair, or you can't hear a woman's voice, or, you know, that to me was the contradiction. The stories that we were studying, though actually in the yeshiva world they don't really study Bible so much, they study more Talmud, which was written later. But the stories we were studying were just so different than the lifestyle we were expected to maintain.
When you were studying at the Zionistic, nationalistic yeshiva in Israel, did it give you a feeling of great community?
Yeah. And people also forget that there's a real mystical and spiritual component to this movement. Friday night, I mean, first of all, it's just so picturesque. I mean, you know, you find yourself outside of Beit El, and especially people who grew up with the Bible. And that's why I'm saying there's a soft side. That's why I don't like to sort of make, you know, kind of make these blanket brush statements about, I mean, what was interesting to me about these, what I would call these Messianic Zionists, is they were actually much less fundamentalist than the more traditional diaspora Eastern European Jews. They were more mystical and they were more active. They would serve in the military. They were very much about hiking, about enjoying the nature, about knowing their history. So that's how you kind of get swept up in it, especially if you come from America and all of a sudden, literally, it's like being, I mean, you're walking through villages that haven't changed in 500 to 1,000 years. And, I mean, you have wells and you have donkeys and goats and shepherds. And on some level, it's almost like being the sheriff. It was. I'm sure it's very similar to what the early pioneers felt, you know, when they were sort of, you know, in that wild, untapped new world. But the difference is that these settlers really believe that this is their land and that God gave it to them and that they are indigenous and they've always been there. They just took like a 2,000-year break.
We were talking earlier about how when you were living in Jerusalem, you worked at Mike's Place, which was a bar run by a former war photographer. and you met a really wide range of people there. There was also a branch of that bar in Tel Aviv, and that bar, the one in Tel Aviv, was bombed in the spring. 3 people were killed, and I think about 50 people injured. Did you know any of the people who were hurt?
I know the owners of the bar, the people who kind of took it over from Mike. And I've been to that bar because I was living in Israel up until about 14 months ago. So I've been to the Tel Aviv branch. I don't know if I knew anybody who was hurt, but for example, if you notice, like in the movie, the band that we have playing in Mike's place, that is a band that plays at Mike's place. So I think the Rav Shmuel who performed in the film for us, I think his bass guitarist was in a coma for a while. And then they had benefit concerts all across North America to sort of raise money to help the survivors and reopen the bar. I mean, I know all the people who run the bar because they're kind of holdovers from when Mike was there.
Well, Eitan Gorland, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you.
Eitan Gorland wrote and directed the new film, The Holy Land. Coming up, book critic Maureen Corrigan considers Vivian Gornick's admission that she invented some scenes in her esteemed memoir. This is Fresh Air. Last week, in a talk at Goucher College outside Baltimore, journalist and autobiographer Vivian Gornick stunned a crowd of writing students by her admission that some of the scenes and conversations in her acclaimed 1987 memoir, Fierce Attachments, were made up. Gornick also reportedly said that she'd used composite characters for some of her pieces that ran in the Village Voice during her tenure there from 1969 to 1977. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has some thoughts on why, in the wake of so many other similar revelations, Gornick's confession still shocks.
The plot by now is so familiar, it's become its own notorious literary subgenre. A prominent writer of nonfiction, an autobiographer, journalist, historian, confesses to being, or is exposed as being, someone who's played fast and loose with the truth. In this case, the culprit is autobiographer and journalist Vivian Gornick, and her oddly offhand admission came spontaneously to an audience composed partly of journalists and other professional writers pursuing advanced degrees in nonfiction writing. Gornick told them she'd invented some scenes and conversations in her revered memoir, Fierce Attachments. Her readers, Gornick said, were willfully ignorant of this device. Gornick also said that she'd concocted some composite characters for some of her Village Voice pieces. Maybe Gornick thought that in these postmodernist days, where we're all hip to the notion that the word fact should always be written in quotation marks, her audience would be unfazed. But because the crowd was filled with journalists, steeped in the details of the recent Jason Blair debacle at the New York Times, it pounced, reportedly grilling Gornick about ethics in nonfiction. Gornick was taken aback by the response, and a couple of days later, in a phone interview with Salon magazine writer Terry Green Sterling, she denied ever saying that she made up anything in her memoir or used composite characters. I haven't felt this disheartened since historian Doris Kearns Goodwin was accused last year of plagiarism. Or before that, since Benjamin Wilkomirski, author of a childhood Holocaust memoir called Fragments that I reviewed for Fresh Air, turned out to be a fraud who made the whole story up. Any reader who falls in love with a work of nonfiction leaves him or herself open to being betrayed. But I didn't see it coming from Gornick. Her books are mainstays of every course I teach. Sometimes I assign The Romance of American Communism, her moving oral history about the rise and fall of the party, or I'll ask students to read selections from her smart collection of essays, Approaching Eye Level. And I frequently assign Fierce Attachments, her now classic memoir about walking with her aged mother through the streets of New York, reminiscing and arguing about the past. It's a memoir that inspires adjectives like unflinching and honest. It's a memoir that people take to heart. When I did a tribute to books about New York City in the aftermath of September 11th and left Fierce Attachments off the list because I thought it was temporarily out of print, I got emails from listeners, not about the hundreds of other New York books I could have mentioned, but about Fierce Attachments. It hooks you from its very first sentences, in which Gornick recalls the Bronx tenement she grew up in, full of women she describes as shrewd, volatile, unlettered. Gornick writes, "I, the girl growing in their midst, being made in their image, I absorb them as I would chloroform on a cloth laid against my face." Lies don't make an autobiography a lesser work of literature. In the women's autobiography course I teach, we always study the work of Mary McCarthy and Lillian Hellman, each of whom famously accused the other of lying, and both of whom told some world-class whoppers. But what lying does do is damage the relationship between reader and memoirist. Autobiography is a genre that is defined solely by a handshake. There's no internal distinction between an autobiographical novel and an autobiography. Rather, it's the autobiographer's pledge to try to tell the truth that makes a reader respond differently. I say try because, as the theorists rightly point out, autobiography is an impossible genre. Time and literary style inevitably distort memories, and the person writing is not the same person who lives the life. But the autobiographer gives his or her word to try, and we readers give our trust. And when this quaint contract turns out to be a con, we feel like rubes. Gornick is still a wonderful writer, and I'll continue to read and reread her work, but with my guard up. But it's irritating and saddening to hear how casually she's confessed to letting down her end of the bargain.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by A&D and Cold Case Files, an original forensic series. Evidence talks when victims can't. Mondays and Tuesdays at 9, 8 Central. A&D, the art of entertainment. And from Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Pink Slip, a novel about love, work, and family by Rita Cerisi, author of Remind Me Again Why I Married You. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, investigating Enron's deceptive practices, we talk with Wall Street Journal reporters John M. Schwiller and Rebecca Smith. Their new book, 24 Days, chronicles the demise of Enron and their experiences breaking key parts of the story. Join us for the next Fresh Air.